Good. Okay. This week is Parshat Shmini, and I was checking through the records. We really haven't talked about Parshat Shmini too much in the last few years because it always comes either a couple of weeks before Pesach, which is always jam-packed full of other stuff in a Shana Mu'beret, or it's come too close to Pesach. Whatever it is, Parshat Shmini, we're going to take a look at it. And this is something that that I've wanted to kind of explore for a while. And unfortunately, it also becomes very timely for another reason. As you know, this past year has been inordinately impactful as far as the loss of great teachers. I think about Rav Steinsaltz. I think about Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. I think about Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Lamb. I mean, the people that we've lost this year it's staggering because it's on a pile on top of all of the other things that we've lost and that we're grappling with. But I got a particularly shocking piece of news right before Pesach when I was told that my friend Rav Ronen Neuwirth was hospitalized. Rav Neuwirth, a dear friend, who brought me to his shul in Ranana a number of years ago, and I gave a shiur there during the 9 days, and then he brought me there for Shabbat, and the only time I was ever imagined being a scholar in residence at a shul in Israel, for my one Shabbat in Israel that during that season, and I just had a delightful time. I had a delightful time with his family, got to know his family, one of his kids, and I hit it off really well. We later brought his wife here. She is a scholar in her own right and a judge in Tel Aviv, and she helped do a Shabbaton with us at Beulah Girls School a couple of years ago. And then I got a call that and he had just put out a book in English on halachic attitudes or attitudes towards halacha in our day. A really marvelous, very well put together book, and I had written a review for it a couple months ago. And then we got a news item from some friends in common that he was hospitalized. And then Chol HaMoed found out that on the first day of Pesach, he passed away. And it's a tremendous loss for Klal Yisrael. Rav Ronen Neuwirth, who was the rabbi in Ohel Ari in Ranana, he was serving as a rabbi in Caesarea at the time that he passed away, was somebody who was highly energized on behalf of all of Am Yisrael, was a person filled with Ahavat Yisrael, filled with love for the Jewish people and a love of Torah and a real passionate desire to bring those two together. And I'm still honestly reeling from it. I mean, we've all had some losses. I have a dear friend whose mother passed away last week, but she was 95, had not been well for a while. That's a very different story, but he was 50 years old and he was, as far as I knew, healthy until fairly recently. And so I'd like to dedicate this year to his memory, but also to the inspiration of his life. And of course, one of the things that happens when an inspiring person passes is that then gives all of us who had the privilege of knowing him and working with him the added responsibility of taking that inspiration and pushing it further. And you'll see why the particular topic of this year is really appropriate to what Rav Ronen Zichro Livracha, it's going to be hard to say that for a while, but Rav Ronen stood for. Parshat Shmini is made up of three separate parts. The first part, which is basically chapter 9, is the dedication of the culmination of the process of dedication of the Mishkan and the instructions for all the things that are to be done on the first day of the real worship of the Mishkan after the 7 days of investiture, which are called Yimei HaMiluim. And then chapter 10 should be the most powerful, celebratory, exciting chapter in all of Chumash, maybe in all of Tanakh, maybe in all of human literature, which is the dedication of the Mishkan, the enshrining of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in an abode here on earth. What could be more magnificent? And yet, chapter 10 revolves around something that's very different than that, which is the tragic death of Nadav and Avihu, Aharon's sons, which is at the beginning of the chapter, and the whole rest of the chapter is informed by that event. And all of the offerings are colored by that event. And all of the celebration is not only muted because of that event, but is shifted because of that event, but not fully shifted. Okay, so the exegetical problem that we have in this story is, why did Nadav and Avihu die? We don't know. We will read the pasuk. We'll see that there's the opaqueness of the pasuk, the unclarity of the pasuk rises well above anything that it clarifies. So take a look here in pasuk Aleph. We have it. Vayikhuvnei Aaron Nadav Avihu ish machtato. So they each took their own censer, their own holder for the incense. Vayinuvahen esh, they put fire in there. Vayasimu l'aktoret, and they put some incense in there. L'aktoret. Vayakrivu l'fnei Adonai esh zarah, they offered a foreign fire. We don't know what that means, a foreign fire. Does it mean, as one interpretation is, that they were supposed to use the fire that had come down from heaven, instead they used a humanly generated fire? Or was it just an offering that wasn't commanded? Asher lot tziva otam, that they did not command them. That's what made it foreign. Unclear. So fire did come out from God, but instead of devouring the Torah, it devoured them. They died right there in the presence of God. Horrible tragedy. And now, we don't know why they died. Moshe says to Aaron words of perhaps consolation, and Aaron is famously silent. And then Moshe arranges for the things that need to be done, which is to have their cousins pull the bodies out, because Eleazar and Itamar, the two now remaining sons who are now going to take their places as Aaron's Kohanim, as it were, as his Kohanim Hedyotim, the regular Kohanim, are told to come and take the bodies out, so because the others shouldn't become Tameh and the place should not become Tameh, and they take them out. And then Moshe instructs Aaron and Eleazar and Itamar not to engage in mourning practices. Let everybody else engage in the mourning practices. You have the job to do, which is to continue and finish the process of inauguration. We still don't know why they died. But the strongest approach among the commentators is they died because they came in some form of inebriation. Now, there's no hint to that in the psukim that describes their death. But the reason for that observation is because of these psukim. The psukim that I wrote big, that I put in big font, are four psukim that come right after Moshe's instructions to Aaron, and then there's going to be more instructions. And this is a unique pasuk. It does not show up anywhere else in Tanakh. Vayedaber Adonai el Aharon lemor. Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe lemor is the most common pasuk that exists. There's more of those than anything else. Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe v'el Aharon shows up a number of times. There is one time where we have in Yoshua, Vayedaber Adonai el Yehoshua lemor. But Vayedaber Adonai el Aharon lemor only shows up here. Then Hashem should speak to Aaron and exclusively to Aaron, only here. And it's not as if it's a narrative where he's telling Aaron, go and meet Moshe and become his partner. It is exactly in the context of a command, exactly like it's done with Moshe. And here's the command. Yayin v'shechar, so wine and strong drink, al tesht ata uvanecha itach, you or your sons with you. And think about how painful those words are. My sons, I just buried my sons, the other sons. B'voachem eloha moed v'lo tamutu. When you come into the tent of meeting, and therefore you will not die. Implication being that if you come in drunk, you will die. Chukat olam l'dorotechem. And this is a perennial law. It isn't just a law for today in the inauguration ceremony. It is forever. And from there, we get the category among those who are chayav mita bidei shamayim, a heavenly death, shtuye yayin, people who are drunk on wine. We're not talking about anybody. We're talking about kohanim doing avodah. And then the command continues to Aharon. Ulahavdil Ben HaKodesh, Uven HaChol, Uven HaTamayah, Uven HaTahor. And to distinguish between holy and unholy, and between impure and pure. Now, what does that mean? So from the simple read of the text, it would sound like you may not get drunk so that you don't come in and die, and so that you can also distinguish between holy and unholy, pure and impure. Or it may mean that when you are in the Mikdash, you have to be able to distinguish between holy things, which you are surrounded by, and treat them properly. If you're drunk, you can't make that distinction. Okay? So far, we're not sure what Pasuk Yod is talking about. Is it speaking about behavior in the Mikdash and not coming in drunk is to prevent you from violating that behavior? Or is it talking about something else? So the last Pasuk guides us in a slightly different direction. Ulahorot et b'nei Yisrael. And to instruct. Lahorot, the same word as Torah. To instruct b'nei Yisrael. Et kol ha-chukim, asher dibar Adonai aleihem b'yad Moshe. All the laws that Hashem spoke to them through Moshe. And that's this passage, which means that this passage is clearly a prohibition against something with the Aaron and B'nai Aaron getting drunk on wine. Getting drunk on wine and entering the Ohel Moed, that will cause you to be killed. But what's the rest of it? Is it that you can do whatever kind of distinguishing and teaching and instructing, as long as you don't go into the Mikdash, and that's fine while you're inebriated? Or is this extending out? The truth is, I don't know. When I ask the questions, these are the Jason questions, I ask the questions, right? Why does the prohibition of entering the Mikdash while inebriated appear here? And the Parshani explanation is because it's there, it's here, instead of, let's say, at the beginning of at the end of Yitro, when it talks about the sanctity of the Mizbeach, because we want to connect it to the death of Nadav and Avihu, either because they came in inebriated, or just because they came in the wrong way and were killed. So here's a warning against doing something else that's wrong and not being killed as a result, right? Why is the focal point here to distinguish between holy and unholy, etc., right? And the last pasuk, what's that doing there about instructing B'nai Yisrael regarding all of the laws? This last pasuk that's in purple with the yellow highlight would seem to be about teaching Torah and not about serving in the Mikdash. What does this have to do with it? So the Midrash in source 2, Vayikra Rabba, is not the beginning of, but it's towards the beginning of a history of parshanut, of exegesis on Nadav and Avihu's death. Why did they die? And throughout the generations, there have been numerous proposals raised. But this Midrash, a very famous passage, we don't know why they died, the Midrash says. But the fact that God then follows it up with a command to Aaron and says, do not drink wine, they died because of wine, right? In other words, they died because they came in drunk, and that's why the command is there, and that explains the location. However, we have to understand what that last pasuk about the pasuk about distinguishing and about instructing. What are they doing here? So the Gemara in Masachet Kretot has the following passage. So passage 3. Tanu Rabbanan. Ulahavdil ben HaKodesh uben HaChol, which, again, we would think in the context of the pasuk meant to distinguish between the fact that you're in a holy place and treat it appropriately, and you're not out there in a mundane place, which you could treat however you want. And therefore, you can't come into the Mikdash drunk because you might mistreat the place. No. The Gemara says, Elu damin va'arachin charamin bekdeshot. This is referring to items that an individual might have committed himself to donate to the Beit HaMikdash. And in this case, it's holy. In this case, the holiness does not obtain. And in order to know that, it's not about things inside the Mikdash. Bein ha-tamei u-bein ha-tahor, what's that? Elu tmeot v'taharot. But the next pasuk, lo-horot, zu hora'a. Now, hora'a is a particular teaching function, which is instructing halacha, making what we would call a psak halacha. That's called hora'a. Et kol ha-chukim elu midrashot, that includes even explanations, which means this drasha is taking the verse here, the last verse, and saying essentially you're not allowed to do any of those things when you're drunk, to make decisions about particular areas of halacha, or to teach midrashim, which means interpretive pieces, or Talmud, any of it. Okay, So now we look back at the pasuk and we get a whole different picture. That what the Kohen is warned against doing a whole bunch of things, all while drunk, not coming to the mikdash, not trying to make determinations about halacha between Kodesh and Chol and Tameh and Tahor, and not to instruct or teach in any way while drunk. Okay, we can understand that. But then the question comes when we take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam, as we all know, was a paragon of precision. Every word in the Rambam was measured. The Rambam, by the way, had several versions of the Mishneh Torah, meaning he went over the Mishneh Torah and made corrections and erased words and corrected words because he wanted it to be perfect. His economy of language is legendary. His care for organizational consistency and consideration is just paradigmatic of what a work should look like. The fact that the Rambam totally revolutionized the system of halachic works is something that's well known, because before the Rambam came along, halacha was essentially an abridgment of the Gemara in one form or another. And the Rambam totally revolutionized it and devised a system not of six, but of 14 categories of law, and within them subcategories, within them chapters, etc. And everything was put where it was for a reason. You notice that the Rambam has this law, which is in Halacha Gimel and Dalet, about the prohibition to teach Torah when drunk, not where you would expect it, which is in the laws of Talmud Torah, but rather in the laws of entering the Mikdash. And it's a wondrous, strange thing, but there's something very powerful behind it. The Rambam rules as follows. In the earlier halachot, he said a Kohen is not allowed to enter the Mikdash when inebriated. And if he does so, he's Chayav Mita. All right, that we got from the simple text of the Torah. And now he says, Uchashem, she'asur le'kohen likanes le'mikdash b'nei ha'shichrut. A Kohen is barred from entering the Mikdash when he's drunk. Kach asur le'chol adam, anybody, Bein Kohen, Bein Yisrael, which, by the way, is a superfluous phrase, because the minute you say the Chol Adam, you clearly mean non-Kohanim. Because right? The opening thing is a Kohen can't do this. Similarly, nobody. So nobody means Kohen or Yisrael. Lahorot Kshehu Shatui, which means none of us may teach Torah when we're drunk. Afilu, watch this, Achal Tmarim. Let's say you had a sugar rush. You ate a bunch of dates. Or you drank some milk in such a way that it made you a little tipsy because, again, of a rush of particular adrenaline or something. Al yoreh, you're not allowed to teach, not allowed to instruct. Let's see what that means. Shenemar lo'ot b'nei Yisrael. Bim horam b'davar shemufurash b'Torah. If you instructed regarding something that's explicit in the Torah, like you got out and said, Shabbat is on Saturday. Are you not allowed to light a fire on Shabbat? Something explicit in the Torah. An shidu hatzdokim. Even the Sadducees agree to it because it's explicit. Mutar. That you're allowed to do. Somebody comes up to you when you're a little drunk and says, are you obligated to put on tefillin? Said, yes. That you could say. Kegon shorash asheretz tamei v'tfardeya tahor. Good. V'adam asur kayotzi bazeh. However, to instruct on what to do if you spoke between tefillin shel-yah and tefillin shel-rosh, something that's not explicit in the Torah, and take some halachic knowledge, then you're not allowed to give an answer when you're drunk. You have to say, I'm sorry, not allowed to answer. The Gemara tells us that Rava would not have an Amora standing near him on Yom Tov, because he would be teaching in the Beit Midrash, but an Amora was there to broadcast the halacha. He would not teach any practical halacha on Yom Tov, because he had had something to drink at the meal. He wasn't drunk. But you had some wine at the meal. But then the Rambam says, Umutar l'shikor l'lamed Torah. But a person who is shikor, by the way, this doesn't mean ripping drunk. This means somebody who has had some wine is allowed to teach Torah. Va'afilu halachot u'midrashot, even halacha, even midrashot. Unlike what the Gemara has said here. V'hu shelo yoreh, as long as it's not done in an instructive manner. We have to see what that means. But let's say he is a chacham who is always teaching and instructing, meaning instructing halacha, he can't teach. And I'll give you a contemporary example of that. When he teaches, that becomes an instruction. A contemporary example that you're all familiar with. Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal, when he would give shir, would often make observations that were part of his learning. He never came in drunk, but he made observations as part of his learning. They were musings about what he thought about how this should happen, that should happen. And students wrote them down. And what do you think happened as a result? People started reading them, started studying them, and people started practicing that way because the Rav said it. That's what we got to do. Now, the Rav didn't necessarily intend it that way. But since the Rav was of such an august and respected position, everything he taught became instruction. And therefore, he couldn't teach anything if shikor. I mean, he didn't. But notice that a regular person like me, I'm giving a shiur, so I could speak about why Nadav and Avihu died, etc., even if I'd had some wine. I haven't. But even if I'd had some wine. Because unless I actually rule on a halachic manner, nobody's going to take what I'm saying as a ruling. But here's the question. Why is there this distinction between hora'ah and limud? And why did the Rambam put this in the laws of Biat Mikdash? Why is it not in the laws of Talmud Torah, right? Or Mamrim, where it talks about the Beit Din, right? It's very strange stuff. So I'd like to suggest the following. You start with Pasuk 9, Source 9. When we stood at the foot of Har Sinai, we made a brit with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised us the end of the terms of the brit. At the very beginning, God said, go ask B'nai Israel, do you want the brit? If you want the brit, this is what's going to happen. And the end of the terms of the brit were, Ve'atem tiyu li mamlechet kohanim ve'goy kadosh. You will be to me a kingdom of kohanim and a holy nation. So what happened to that? We're not a kingdom of kohanim. We're a nation with some kohanim and some non-kohanim, mainly non-kohanim. So what happened to that promise? And interestingly enough, in a prophecy about what things are going to look like when the world comes to a full realization of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Elohei Yisrael, we have a prophecy in Yeshayahu, in Samach Aleph, Yatem Kohanei Adonai Tikareyu. You will be called, you and Israel will be called the Kohanim of Hashem, Mishartei Eloheinu Yemar Lechem. You will be called the ones who worship, who serve our God. What does that mean? What's our job as Kohanim? So let's roll back to the beginning of Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu of Yerushalayim has the famous nevuah. We all know it. At the end of days, source 8, the mountain of Hashem is going to be the mountain that houses the house of God, Har Bayit, is going to be firm as high of the mount, as a high mountain, so we'd say highest, most esteemed among the mountains, and nations will stream to it. And they're going to say, let us go to Hashem, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will instruct us. There's that word, Yorenu. He will instruct us of his ways, and we'll follow his paths, because Mitzion Tetzei Torah Udvar Adonai Mishalayim. So in other words, instruction of how to live is supposed to come from Mishalayim. And this is part of the job of a Kohen. If you look back at source 7, Malachi, after his diatribe against the Kohanim, who are not behaving properly at the beginning of the Second Temple period, says ki siftei kohen yishmeru dat. The proper kohen is somebody whose lips always hold on to knowledge. The Torah yivakshu mipiu. Everybody requests Torah instruction from him. Ki malach Adonai tzvotu. He's a paragon of virtue. But what's this all about? So, where does a Beit Din sit? A Beit Din sits wherever people there are Jewish people and they establish a Beit Din. But where does the central Beit Din sit? The central Beit Din sits in the place where Hashem makes his name cause to reside. That's in Dvarim. The Beit Din HaGadol sits right there in the courtyard of the Beit HaMikdash, in the Azara. And the part of the Azara, that's part of it is mundane, so that non-Kohanim can be there, and so that they can sit there. And the Rambam says, Beit Din HaGadol Shirushalayim, I'm rolling backwards to source 5, Heim Ikar Torah Sheba'al Peh. Torah Sheba'al Peh essentially emanates from the Beit Din HaGadol Yerushalayim, Heim Amudei HaHora'ah, they are the pillars of instruction, and they stay right there in the place of Mikdash. That's our, okay, so now, What's going on? The answer is that Kohanim, we are Mamlachet Kohanim, but Kohanim have two functions. One function is Kohanim representing us to God. But one function is Kohanim representing God to us. One function is Kohanim who do the Avodah on our behalf. We bring a Korban, the Kohen brings the Korban on our behalf. The Kohen comes close. The Kohen Gadol goes as close as anybody could go into the Kodesh Kodoshim. And they represent us in there. But the other piece is the Kohanim representing Dvar Hashem and being the ones who share Dvar Hashem with us. But there are two different functions there. There's a function called Limud, which is teaching, informing, inspiring, exhorting, clarifying, analyzing. That's Limud. But there's yet another function, which is a function called Hora'ah. Hora'ah is making a determination, a final determination, and saying Tahor, Tameh, Kasher, Pasul, acceptable, unacceptable. And that determination is a Kohanic function that every Jew can participate in if they sit down and study and get to the point where they're in a position to actually issue such rulings. The Rambam is saying something so powerful here just by the location where he puts this law. The law of any Jew, and he emphasizes it, Bein Kohen, Bein Yisrael, whether the Jew is a Kohen or not a Kohen. Any Jew who gets to a position of instructing in halacha is acting as a Kohen. He is, as it were, entering into the Mikdash. And therefore, the prohibition of him being drunk applies just like it does to a Kohen going into to bring an offering. Because the Kohen's function works in two directions. The one direction, which is the Kohen representing us with Korbanot, that's only Aaron and his kids. But the other the direction of HaKadosh Baruch Hu being represented by the Kohanim also devolves upon all of Am Yisrael, anybody who devotes their time to study and to apprenticeship to the point where they can actually rule. That's Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. And what is Torah? Lahavdil Ben HaKodesh Uvein HaChol. It's something that's politically very incorrect and very unpopular these days. To actually say, this is okay and this is not okay. And not, well, in some, no, this is okay and this is not okay. This is kasher and this is treif. And to be able to make that determination to represent there really is a religious boundary, there really is a moral boundary, there really is a legal boundary, and there really is an ethical boundary, and you're on the other side of it. And this is where the boundary is a Kohanic function. And so therefore, the Rambam here presents the laws of instruction and the prohibition of instruction when drunk for any Jew to do in the laws of Biat Mikdash, because when we engage in that activity, we are acting as Kohanim representing the Mikdash. Now, most of us, myself included, are not going to get to the position of Hora'ah in the grand halachic sense. But we all have the opportunity to get engaged, to be engaged in the process of Hora'ah in a more local sense, in a more, shall we say, not pedestrian sense, but tame sense of actually looking at situations and being able to honestly say, you know what? This is not okay. And this is okay. This is laudatory behavior. And this is not laudatory behavior. And in that, we take a little piece of the Kohanic function. My dear friend, Rav Ronen, Zichro Livracha, was somebody who I was not a Kohen, as far as I know, he was not a Kohen. And yet he was a Kohen. He was somebody who had the Midot of Aharon, which is Ohev et HaBriot u'Mekavan LaTorah, without a doubt. He loved the Jewish people and did everything he could to bring them close to Torah. But he also was somebody who, on the one hand, engaged in Hora'ah, but on the other hand, had the wisdom to know how to present Torah in a way that people could hear it. And that, of course, is part of the challenge, not just to know what's right, but how to communicate what's right in a way so that people can accept it, hear it, and be compelled by it and want to join along into trying to create a more perfect world. Yehi Zechro Baruch. I hope that his memory, I pray that his memory be a source of blessing to all of us and a schut for all of Klal Yisrael.